It's that. It is that kind of meeting, isn't it? I was. I'd like to thank Ian, who asked me to speak tonight, and Tony for the meeting, and Claudia for a fantastic share, which really grounded me and just reminded me what the fuck I'm doing here. And I was sitting here as everybody was kind of gathering, and it reminded me of a meeting I used to go to when I first came to NA. When I started my recovery, it was in December of 88, but I was in a rehab. I didn't get to meetings until 89. He said a meeting on a Saturday morning, which was ironically, it began at midday, and it was ironically called Early Risers. For an NA, for an NA member, that was about right. And it was such a fucking scene. It was a great meeting. I had a lot of energy, and there were a lot of people who'd been there. It wasn't that old a fellowship in those days, but there were some great characters in there. And remember, I'm kind of jumping ahead a bit. I'll go back. I don't talk in a straight line, but I know you don't listen in a straight line. That's fine. I got the tea commitment, which was fucking, I couldn't, you know, it was like a badge of honour. I thought, I'm going to be the best fucking tea person they've ever had. I spent my own money on the fuck I got. I had chamomile, I had three berries, I had robot, I had fucking racks of tea, and you know, it was like Twinings, man. It was like the whole. And then this member who had been going for a while, so she was an old timer. She'd been like, you know, she was like 5 years or something. And I was slightly in awe of her and desperate to please. And she said, "You got any decaf coffee?" Fucking forgot the decaf coffee. And that was in, I came out of that shame spiral about 1995 rather. I felt so awful and a failure, and I shared about it for about a month. Anyway, I'll get back to the beginning. I was born in Liverpool in 1955, and my parents, I was an only child, which is weird because my big Liverpool Irish working class family. But you know, my mother, who's actually been sober as long as I have, she got sober about a month after I did. She got sober, I got clean in rehab, and she got sober in meetings in Liverpool. And she's quite a hysterical woman. I think she had one kid, and she thought, I'm never going through that again. So that was the end of that. But my dad's brothers and sisters had thousands of kids, and I was his only child. So I felt really, really strange in my family. And there was definitely something wrong with me and my parents that we only had one kid. Which created two things. One, I was an overachiever, so I had to prove everybody wrong. And I was very anxious pretty much all of the time. And I covered it up. I covered it up by being very extrovert, and I'd stay up late at parties. First of all, they all drank in my house. They drank when there was a Y in the day, really. They drank. Someone said about my family, the only time my father refused a drink was when he misunderstood the question. And he was a fantastic bloke, and he was a really good company. And my mother actually was more of a problem drinker, who'd fall over and cause fights. One bloke said to her, "Hey, love, you cause a row in a fucking empty house, you." Because she was a very sweet woman, and then you put some alcohol in her, and she became this monster. And I grew up in that environment, and so basically, my first experience of taking substances was alcohol. I was about 13, and I would get drunk. I'd go to pubs that would serve 13-year-olds in Liverpool, and there are quite a few. And from a very early age, I was very reckless. Even though I was a very anxious kid, you put drink inside me, I became this reckless fucking lunatic. I would try and stop traffic by lying down in the road in a kind of black coat at 11:30 at night. Fortunately, I had bright ginger hair in those days, and so they kind of thought, "What is that? What's that? Is that like a cat or something?" And I was very emotionally kind of, you know, unbalanced. I'd often go in, I'd have tantrums, I'd get very upset. And I was a clever boy at school. I did well. And I remember being at school, and I said to him, I have one male friend, David. I sat next to him. I was late for everything. In my school report, it had 45 times late in one term. And a comment at the bottom saying, Jimmy works very hard at school, but he seems to have the total inability to accept even the slightest piece of constructive criticism. I don't know whether anybody identifies with that in this room. I was kind of wound up all the fucking time. And when I used to sneak drinks and go to the pub, I felt relaxed, and nothing put me off it. I mean, I remember once going to a chippy in Liverpool, and we would call it chicken curry and chips. It was actually just chicken and chips with a lot of sauce, spicy sauce poured all over it. And I ate it. I remember going back to the house, and my parents didn't realize that their 14-year-old was off his tits, because they were off their tits. So you had these three people with their own personal rooms spinning around their heads. I remember getting very tight in the jaw, thinking I'm going to be sick. And I ran up the stairs, and I just made it in time. I remember, at some stage, pulling huge bits of chicken out of my nose. Enjoy your dinner tonight. And when I look back, when I was encouraged in rehab to look back at my patterns of using and drinking, I could see that was weird. And as a kid then, I just went out the following night, I wanted to, you know, do more of it. And then I got a girlfriend. So I had one male friend and one girlfriend, and I didn't want anybody else in my life. And I said to the pair of them, right, this is it, we're the team. Fuck everybody else. And I made a statement, which is so sad for a 13 or 14-year-old to make, was, I don't want anyone to like me or love me. I just want them to admire me and fear me. And of course, the opposite was true. But I was convinced I was unlovable. Totally and utterly convinced. Remember once, my close friend in the street, we lived in like a Coronation Street kind of set up, little terraced houses. And Peter was my mate, and he said, do you want to come into town with me and my Auntie Olive? And Peter didn't have a dad, and we were told he was killed in the war. And when I got old enough to work out, I said, Mum, which war was his dad killed in? Because Peter's the same age as me, and there weren't any fucking wars for him to be killed in. If he was killed in the Second World War, she was pregnant for 15 years. What was going on? And clearly she was a single mother who'd been impregnated by a married man who'd fucked off. But in those days in Liverpool, no one ever talked about that. So that's what it was like. It was lots of things that weren't spoken about in our street. And I remember saying, I'd love to come to town with you. And I ran across the street and I stood on his doorstep and I saw him go up the stairs and say to his Auntie Olive, can Jimmy come to town with us? And her saying, oh no, not him. And I remember just dying to death and I just scuttled off home. But that's how I grew up. I grew up feeling and believing that there was something wrong with me. To cut a long story short, I got to a very good university and I went round to finish with my girlfriend at the time because I was going to university and we'd been going out from the age of 14, 15. I was now 18 and I went round to see her and I said, look, you know, I'm going to university. She said, yeah. And her lips started to quiver. I said, so I think it's only sensible now. And then the eyes began to brim with tears, if we got married. Because I didn't really want to upset her. And I thought, in the back of my mind, I'll think of something. So I'm there I am at the altar. And my dad, God bless my father, actually. My dad, it was strange, my dad was dead 40 years on Wednesday, and I still miss him. And we're driving up to the church, he said, Jimmy, for fuck's sake, get on a plane to Ireland. We'll hide you in Ireland for a week. I'll explain to everybody, please don't do this. Now, I've got a 19-year-old son, and I tell him the story. He can't believe what a fucking idiot I was. But I had to explain to him, I didn't have the emotional vocabulary to split up with anybody. I didn't know how to end anything. So, I'm at the altar, and I'm saying to my mate David, I don't want to do this. And then we went to this university. She came with me, and I would just go out every night, and I started using drinking, and you know, and then other things came in, got put into the mix. I was out most nights, getting shit-faced, lying, and she had a terrible, terrible time. And in the end, I left university. Our marriage didn't last, and I was horrible to her. Like I said, I didn't know how to leave her well, so I left her badly. I just pissed off, I just fucked off one day. I never came back. I didn't see her for another 15 years when I tried to make amends. That's for a whole other chair, making amends. And then I got a job in an industry that I really loved, and I wanted to be in that industry, and then that's when I got heavily into narcotics. And when I had it for the first, when I had my first experience of class A drugs, I didn't want to do anything else. I just thought, this is what I'm supposed to feel like. This is it. What's wrong with it? I can handle it. It's all fine. And when we were, just before the meeting starts, and because I don't think about my using a lot. I know I got clean when I was 33. I'm 63 now. I know you're thinking, he's not 63, is he? But I'm 63. I hate saying it out loud, which is why I say it out loud. I can't fucking believe I'm 63. I hate it. I don't think about my using that much anymore, because I've got a wife and four kids who've never seen me use. I've got a job. I've got everything is come back. I've got a great life that coming here has given me. But when I was here just before the meeting started, I remembered some of the things that I got into. I thought, was that me? I remember waking up once. I was supposed to be at work, a big project I was involved in. I needed to be there on that day at 8 a.m., otherwise we couldn't do the project. And I woke up on a dealer's floor surrounded by parakeets. And if you've never experienced it, it is like hell. It's like, because I was completely strung out. I was coming down off like a three-day fucking bender. And I didn't know where I was, and all I could see was like 15 parakeets staring at me, squawking at me. It was like something out of fucking Breaking Bad. And I had to go to the person, my boss I was working for, and he cancelled the day, which cost a lot of money. And I said to him, look, I think I've got a drug problem. And he said, well, thank you for being honest. If you do it again, we'll fire you. In fact, we'll sue you, and you'll be finished in your job. I said, fair enough. And he was a very nice man, very, very English, very proper. You know, he'd been to Harrow. He was very posh. The following Wednesday, I did exactly the same thing. Me and the fucking parakeets woke up together again. Only this time, it wasn't a crucial day. And I ran into work, and the bloke I worked with didn't grasp me up. I just got in time before the bus came in, and I was okay. But that, in a way, was enough to make me think, what is going on with me? Because I loved what I did for a living. What the fuck was I doing? Along the way, I got involved with another relationship. And her father was an only child, Irish, hopeless alcoholic who'd fucked off when she was 17. And it's only looking back, you realize how we fitted so well together. And we were like completely, completely enmeshed. I loved this woman. I was completely head over heels in love with her. And she was with me, but it was like two kids. We were just like two kids. Two very smart, angry, fucked up kids trying to have a relationship. And on my second date with her, I said something I thought was completely innocuous. She turned the table over, slammed the door, got into her car and fucked off up the road, and I thought, I want to marry her. She's the girl for me. We go to friends' houses for like, we invited around for like dinner or something. and we kick off, and you can see everybody going, oh, for fuck's sake, will you two just calm down? And we couldn't solve any problems. Any problem became the Third World War. And anyway, we were living in the same house together. In fact, we bought this house together. It's in 1987. And she confronted me with a lawyer's letter and said, the lawyer's letter said, if you don't sort your problem out, my client would like you to leave the property. And so I decided to go and see a counselor. I didn't really know about meetings, to be honest. I didn't know that this all was here. And I went to see a psychiatrist on Harley Street. I thought, you know, you go to Harley Street, I now know it's full of fucking charlatans, but in those days, I thought, you know, you go to Harley Street, bloke in a suit, knows what he's talking about. Anyway, so after about half an hour, this bloke called Gerald, he said, he's a very nice man, he said, I can't help you. He said, you're a junkie. And you haven't told me one single true thing in the last half an hour. And my technique for being, when I was confronted like that, and I was, someone really angered me and upset me, I would smile at them. Right, okay, yeah, sure. He could have called me a cunt, I would have gone, oh really? I didn't know how to respond to anything. I was just a collection of empty gestures, jokes, and naked aggression. Someone said to me, you can make good morning sound like a declaration of war. It's just to keep you all out there and keep the plate spinning. It doesn't matter what I felt like on the inside, as long as you thought I was doing all right, that was my main job. He said to me, I do know a woman who may be able to help you. She's quite good with drug addicts and alcoholics. Go and see her. So I went to see this woman. She had a treatment center. And she saw me for a few weeks. She said, why don't you go to some meetings? I said, I don't do meetings. I don't do groups. I don't want to do that. She said, well, I suggest you go and meet these two men. So I met these two guys in an estate agent's in Sydney Street in Chelsea. I thought, what the fuck am I doing? I've got a problem with drugs. I don't want to buy a flat. I was sitting there with these two guys, and it comes out with three coffees, and I'm thinking, when are they going to tell me how to control my using and get the balance right between, you know, the vodka and the coke and the... And this guy said, well, I was born in Somerset. I started... I thought, what the fuck are you? I don't care where you were born. And he started telling me his story. And the other bloke started telling me his story, like I was interested. Anyway, they said, and now we're going to go to a meeting. And here's the thing, because I was such a people pleaser, I couldn't tell what I was thinking, which was, go fuck yourself. I went, great! Great, let's go to a meeting! And I went to the Response Bookshop in Earl's Court in the summer of 1987. And I sat there, I went there for 3 weeks with these two guys. One guy was really big. He died last year, he's a fantastic bloke. And the fourth week, they didn't come. I thought, great, I can stop coming. But I had to tell my girlfriend that I was still going, because the deal was, you got to go to meetings and see a counselor and get a whole team going to stop you from fucking up your life. So what I used to do is I used to leave the house at the required time, and I go to the pictures. So I go see a movie. I saw Midnight Run 9 times. And I never saw the ending, because I had to get back in time, so I'd have to leave. I only found how it ended last Christmas when I watched it on the telly. And so when step two arrived, and in the treatment they said, we'd like to talk about, you know, how insane you were. And I said, I'm not insane. And I told them this story about going to the movies, and going back, here's the insane bit. I go back to my house, and I tell my girlfriend in detail what happened in the meeting. That never happened. And it was, my lies was just for fucking brilliant, you know. And if ever you called me on a lie, my outrage was so enormous that you called me out. I would be so hurt, I'd have to leave. So in the end, I tried to be abstinent on my own at the beginning of 1988. And I have to say, it was the worst 6 months of my entire life. Without any help, and without any medication, I don't know how I got through it really. I was angry, snarling, I wouldn't go out. I lost friends. My wife, well, my girlfriend at the time, was as insane as I was. So she said, "You're doing really well. Why don't we get married?" And again, I went, "Fine, fine. We'll get married. We'll get married." So we got married, and we got married in a registry office. And we had this tent, and all my friends were there, all using, all going off to the fucking lavish. I was so full of resentment. I did my wedding speech full of resentment. And then a couple of months after we got married, it's in the March, and I had a really great day at work. And I hadn't been using, I hadn't touched any alcohol. So I was completely abstinent. I was clean and dry, but I wasn't in recovery. And we did the work, and in my industry, when we do work, we have to have a party, because everyone's a fucking child where I work as well, so we have to have parties all the time. And so we had a party, and this guy just went, it was like a monologue, except it was just a look. And he just looked at me and went, which said to me, "Do you want to follow me to the toilet and do a line?" And I went back, and I followed him. I had one line, I had one can of beer, I went home, I thought, how easy was that? You see, it's easy. So anyway, I'm in the rehab 2 months later. And you can imagine what happened, because all the fucking props went bang, all at once. The whole thing came in. I'd lost all restraint. We had a community police officer called Phil, who was knocking on doors one. He ended up living with us for 3 months while I was using downstairs. I had a copper living upstairs. That's how nutty I was. And so I get paranoid thinking, you know, he's undercover. He wasn't undercover. He's in my fucking guest bedroom. I'd forgotten that. I had a policeman living with me for 3 months of my using. And anyway, so I wound up in the rehab, and I sat there day after day, and I don't know whether everyone's been into rehab. I actually believe now I've been to NA for a while. You know, you don't have to go to rehab. Actually, you can come to NA and do exactly the same thing. But it's good for me. It got me off the, got me out of nonsense. It got me into this place, and we kind of sat there in these groups, and I didn't understand what the fuck was going on. And bit by bit, I was supposed to be in there. They said, "You'll be here for 4 weeks." I was there for 13 weeks. And they said, you don't know how to ask for help. I said, "I don't know what you mean." "Well, ask for help for what?" "What do you mean ask for help?" "What, like help to do what?" I said, you're not asking for help, Jimmy. I thought, for fuck's sake, what do you mean? And they do things to me like, "How are you feeling today?" Like, "I'm feeling great." "Why?" And the counselor say, "Because you're looking very scared." Am I? Am I looking scared? I didn't know what I was feeling. I had no idea. And bit by bit, what I didn't realise was that the armoury, the kind of the walls were slowly coming down. And we did this group where they said, "We're going to separate the men from the women." And I assumed it was because we were going to talk about sex. So I thought, great, okay. I'm desperate to know what that old bloke does in this group. And we began. They said, "I want to talk about your childhood." All right. And this old guy who I've been on the case of, I've been horrible to, actually, and picking on him. He, because he was very posh and very old. And there are two things that kind of press my buttons, you know, because my kids who are born in London and talk with a posh accent, they, you know, they often, when we're eating and I'm talking, they'll get a chip and put it on my shoulder. So I was even more chippy in those days, and I've been on this guy's case, and he began to share, and he said, "Well, when I was a child," he's about 60 or 65, 66 at this stage, I had a dog, and Snowy, and he got ill, and we had to put him down, and he began to cry, and I was astounded that this man was moved to tears, because he was so English, he was so proper, so middle class, so buttoned up. And the counsellor said to me, "Are you all right with this, Jimmy?" I went, yeah, I'm fine. She must have seen something. She said, sir, we don't need to talk about your childhood. It was all fine, was it? Great, then we won't talk about Jimmy's childhood. Apparently Jimmy's childhood was fine. Now, witnesses, tell me what happened next. Because I stood up, apparently, and I began to scream at her about fucking joking my childhood was fine. And I began to tell things that I thought I would take to the grave. Things that, you know, any, I'm sure other people here have got experiences when they were children of seeing things that really a child shouldn't see. And you take it with you and you think, I'm never going to tell anybody about that. And apparently I just began to pour it out and I was sobbing. And by the end of it, I was completely spent. And she walked up to me and put her arms around me and said, that was great. That was really great. I thought, there's nothing great about that. I feel ashamed of myself. I feel completely opened up. She said, go and have a bath and come back down and join the group. I was in the bath with my knees under my chin. I was 33 years of age. And I just said to myself, please don't let me feel like this anymore. I'll do anything. I came downstairs, and it always moves me, this. I came down thinking, what will they think of me? This old lady, Anne, she's doing a crossword. She said, come and sit next to me and do the crossword. And somebody else put a coffee in my hand. And they sat next to me. And I just looked around, and nothing had happened. It was fine. And that was my first experience of asking for help. I'd like to say I've always asked for help in my recovery in the last 30 years, but I haven't. You know, I've gone to... I ran out of that treatment centre. I passed. They give me a little thing, little badge. And I went to my first meeting. And I went with somebody that I was in treatment with. And she said to me, I'll wait for you to come out. She came out the day before. And like two, like Hansel and Gretel, we were so frightened. We sat in the front row. And this guy was sharing. The chair was, you know, had been good and I was listening to it. And the guy, this guy said, if you're new, or if you're feeling a bit under the weather, and you don't share, then really, you know, you're a bloody fool, because the only risk you're running, let me tell you now, is the risk of feeling slightly better. I thought, you fuck, you're picking on me, you know I'm new. So instinctively, I put my hand up to share, and then they picked me. Now, when I was a kid, I had a childhood, very bad childhood stammer, which is not surprising. I was very anxious and I couldn't get my name out. So usually, you know, on the phone sometimes, the phone would get picked up and people put the phone down because I couldn't get my name out. So he picked me and I sat there and I couldn't get my fucking name out and it felt like hours. In fact, it was about 9 seconds. And I said, my name is Jimmy. I'm an addict. And I'm scared. And that's all I could say. And then somebody at the back of the room said, I'd like to thank that bloke at the front. I've been coming here for 7 years and I'm frightened this week. I've had a terrible time at work. My boss has got it in for me. And what happened was I kept hearing people identifying or thanking me. And what I realized was they were holding me. And that's been my experience when I come here, is I feel held. It is the good enough mother for me. It holds me. This place holds me when I can't hold myself. Someone said, you know, in here, they see right through you, but they like the view. And I, you know, I'd like to say that, and since then it's all been, but it hasn't. I've had a real life. You know, my wife at the time, I was 5 years clean, and she woke up one morning and said, I thought it was the drugs and the drink I didn't like. It turns out it's you. And that was a really good day. I went to the meeting, I blamed the meeting. I said, you shower fucking bastard, you've made me say all these... I mean, I have to say, I wasn't easy to live with in the first couple of years. I tried to become very religious. And I'm an atheist. But so it's a bit of a... Anyway, I tried my best. I went to church and I used to... I learned off by heart the poem Footprints in the Sand. Is anybody familiar with that poem? And it's quite sentimental, and he talks about, and people will come around for Sunday lunch, old friends who'd still drank and they still did a bit of whatever, but they were my old friends. They come around for Sunday lunch, bit kind of suspicious of what this new life I was in, and they'd be ready, there'd be a bottle of wine on the table, they'd be ready to get into the lamb, and I'd say, before we start, Can I just say something? So these people would put down their knives and forks, and I'd read out footprints in the sand. And then, where the bit where he says, you know, I've always, God said to me, why are the two sets of footprints in the sand? Because I've always walked beside you, my son. And the man looks back over the sand and says, ah, but this bit here where there's only one set of footprints, you said you'd always walk beside me. What was happening then? That, then, my son, was when I carried you. And when I said that, I would always burst into uncontrollable sobbing for about 3 minutes. With people literally just not knowing what the fuck. I lost more friends in my first year of recovery than I did in my last 5 years of using. Because I was, it's all about me. I wasn't much, but I was all I thought about. So that marriage ended, and then I really got into recovery. Then I really had to fucking do this, and I was very fortunate. I met people in here who got me, and I got them. I once listened to a radio program. There's a psychologist called Adam Phillips who said, when children play hide and seek, they play it on the condition they're going to be found. The squeals you hear are the squeals of delight at being found. Imagine the trauma of sending your child out into the woods and then fucking off to the pub for 2 hours. It's like, it's probably happened to some people in this room. He said, and I believe we play this game as adults. We hide. And every now and again, someone sees you. And it's a really exciting moment. And that's what I feel about coming to NA, is that I feel seen and I feel heard. And I've got a small group of friends, one of who's here tonight, who we spent, you know, half our adult lives doing this. And we're growing old in NA. I mean, there's one meeting I go to with, fucking hell, it'll be the Zimmer Frames next. Everybody there is about over 60. I feel like quite young in that meeting. But fortunately, we're all terminally immature, so it kind of balances itself out. And I'll kind of wrap it up, really. I'll bring you up to speed. I met somebody in NA who's actually, she got clean when she was 17. And, you know, she fell off a cliff when she was, you know, injecting addict by the time she was 14, and so she's about 3 years further down the road from me, which she keeps telling me. I have four kids. I have a daughter who's not my daughter, she's my stepdaughter. Her dad died when she was 18 months old, and I got her when she was 3. And I never insisted she call me dad, never. And why? Because she didn't want to risk that, I think, because the first person she called dad fucked off on her. So I used to hear her on the phone. It broke my heart because I really wanted to be called dad. But I spoke to my sponsor, and I never ever asked her to call me dad. I used to hear her on the phone to her friends about her dad, about my dad said this and that. So she was kind of doing it behind my back. And then when she was 19, so I'd known her for 16 years, and I guess I was about 20 years sober, she came in at Christmas, about 2 days before Christmas, and she threw something across the kitchen table and said, I bought you something for Christmas, you can open it now if you like, it'll make you cry. I said, why, what is it? So I opened it, and it's a little silver money clip, and on it she'd had inscribed the word, Dad. And the reason why I tell that story is that if those are the moments that I recall. I used to think it would be the moments of, you know, I'd be at some flash party with oak panel rooms in a black tie being ushered off into private rooms by the Prime Minister asking me my advice before I got into an open top car with at least 3 women and a bag of Coke and some vodka and we go off to a hotel and have wild sex. That's not my life. My life is full of different things, and it is those moments that give me an enormous sense of gratitude that I've learned one thing in here. I've learned how to keep going. No matter fucking what, I just keep going. And my children, you know, my daughter's now in Miami. She's 28 at the end of the month. She's running a little cafe out there. My son's in India somewhere. He's 19. He rang me on Wednesday. And I didn't talk about my own. My own dad killed himself when I was 23. And so he's been dead for 40 years, like I said. And this year, more than any other year, I've thought about him a lot. I don't know why. Maybe I'm getting older. And of course, I've got my daughter in America, my son's in India, my other son's doing A-levels, he's gonna go off to Brazil next year. I've got my little boy who's 14 at home. None of them see me use or drink. And they've also been around a lot of recovering people. And they really like it, because we get around a dinner table or we sit in the kitchen and we're fucking... Remember once we had a first year anniversary for a friend of ours who could never stay clean called Johnny. And he came, and I decided to get someone to cook a meal. So I got this bloke over, and I said, if I give you a few quid, will you cook the meal while we have a chat? And he was a guy, and I said, you know, I poured him a glass of wine. So just an ordinary, like a civilian, is cooking the meal. We have the meal, and then we start sharing to this man about how, you know, what a fucking nightmare he was when he was using, and this guy cooking the meal couldn't believe what people were sharing around the dinner table. I kept seeing the meal through this guy's eyes. He was like, fucking, I can't believe these people. What are these people like? So my children have been exposed to all that. And I said to my son, hey Joe, believe it or not, my dad's been dead for 40 years today. He said, how's it felt? He's 19. I said, strangely, this year, it's felt more, I felt more sad than in many, many years. And he said, well, you see, the thing is, you're going through a lot of loss because, you know, you bring up these kids like me and the other kids with all this unconditional love, and in your case, slightly obsessive. And then we all leave. So actually, maybe this whole loss thing is just, you know, your dad's part of it. I thought, you know what? I couldn't say that when I was 19. NA has raised my children. You know, all I do is I pass this stuff on to my kids as well. I try not to tell my kids what to do. I try and empathize with my kids. I try to remember what it was like for me when I was 18 and 19. It's really helped me in every single area. So I am a very happy customer. And I said to Tony, there's no way I'm going to share till 8:20. But as I'm talking about myself, it's been quite easy. Thank you very much.